I'm going to call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum quite yet, but we'll get started. I think the first bill we can take care of without having to take a vote. So, Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 816, and there is a delete all amendment. I trust the members have that amendment.
Okay. So, Representative Anderson moves the House File 816 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Go ahead with your amendment.
It's the 813 amendment. Do all the members have that, Mr. Chair?
Do all members have the A15 amendment? I'm not seeing anybody say no.
Okay, that's a good sign. Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce House File 816, which is also known as Janet's Law. The main reason I'm doing this is to simply raise awareness to a problem we have here in Minnesota with radon gas and its link to lung cancer. We heard testimony last week from the Department of Health and statistics about the number of people who die each year from lung cancer that's caused, we expect, by high exposure to radon gas. Radon gas is naturally occurring in our soils when uranium-238, I found that out, when it decomposes, and some of that gas can seep up through cracks in foundations and things and such to cause higher levels, which can cause a health concern. It can be remedied with the pipe that passes through the foundation up through the roof, and such systems are already required in new home construction thanks to a 2009 Minnesota law. These systems can be either passive with no fan or an active system which has a fan to draw more air up through that pipe system. And the problem arises because a lot of people just don't know if their homes contain radon gas at levels high enough to be a problem. And after this bill was introduced, a friend emailed me, and I think this is fairly typical of what may be happening. And I use his email with his permission. He says, good idea on testing. My wife brought a test kit home from school, and we had our house tested. It came back with a 20. And I guess it should be down under 4. That microcurie is how they test for radon. I wish I had known when I bought the house. We had a system put in to remove the radon gas this week. I looked this morning, and it was down to 7.5. Hopefully, it does a job because these systems are not cheap, but lung cancer is not any fun either. That was from a friend who emailed back home. I'm calling this bill Janet's Law out of respect and remembrance to one of my wife's best friends, a beautiful lady who died last summer from lung cancer. Here today with us is Janet's sister to tell her story.
Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Please,
I'm Lori.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Please say, just reminding you to state your name for the record, but
yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm Lori Thompson Gary, and I'm Janet's sister. My sister Janet was diagnosed with lung cancer September of 2010. She had found a lump on her breast and had a biopsy, and it was cancer. Thought she had breast cancer. They came back and said, "No, it's lung cancer. It has metastasized to the skin." And the only reason I bring that up is because lung cancer is very silent, in that she had no symptoms, and by the time that they oftentimes find it, in fact 85% of the time, it's metastasized, and then, as you know, you're just buying time. So when the doctor found she had lung cancer and she was a non-smoker, he suggested that she have her home tested for radon because he'd seen this type of cancer only in really heavy smokers. And so she did. She'd recently sold her home in Glenwood, Minnesota, and they went back and tested it, and it was very high. So that's likely the cause of her lung cancer. And she had no idea about the radon levels, really wasn't familiar with it. And she passed away in September, so less than 2 years from the diagnosis. I think, Janet, one of the things that was very, very important to her was telling everyone about this and getting people to get radon tests. It's a very easy thing to do. And so many people that I know have come back and had their homes tested. And there's a couple of things that you may or may not know about it, but in her particular home, it was high, but the people on each side of her, it was normal levels. In my neighborhood, we tested. Ours was fine. There were four other people in the neighborhood, and one was off the charts high. One was considerably high. The other two were very, very low, and all within right next door to each other. So there's no way to say, well, this neighborhood, this city, this town, you know, the radon is high or low. It can be anyone. And so I really would like to see the awareness of this radon test so that when people buy an existing home, they are aware of that and the home is tested.
Okay, I think we have a question from Mr. Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, what is the cost on a test like this?
Go ahead. Either of you can answer. Yeah.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, there's a couple of ways to go on this. You can buy kind of a do-it-yourself test and conduct the test yourself. As I understand, you'd hang this in your basement for a couple of days. It's more accurately done in the wintertime when your home is closed up. The test costs anywhere from $8 to $10 up to $20 for the test, and then you would send that into a lab to get your results. I did talk with the Department of Health, and they recommended that if we really wanted to push this thing to be the safest, most accurate, you would hire a certified tester. They would come into your home and do it under EPA guidelines, do it correctly, so you get a really accurate count, and it would be kind of a standardized number. That cost is about $150 for that test.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, the main concern I've heard about it from some folks back in the district would be kind of, my understanding is this test is left out, and the longer it's left out in the open air, the more accurate it becomes, and that the radon is absorbed into like a cartridge of some sort and then measured. And would there be any, you know, specific amount of time in a sale situation where you'd be requiring, or is it an open-ended?
Requiring what?
For the amount of time that this test be left out in the home.
Mr. Chair, that's the reason, one of the reasons for the amendment. We move that testing up to when the home is listed for sale, because I don't want to interfere with the process of closing a home sale. So in that case, it would be done as the home is listed. But in a private sale, for example, it's not listed, it would take, again, I've heard from 3 to 5 days for this test. So there would be that time length to consider, yes.
We do have a quorum, Representative Anderson, so if you'd like to move your amendment, we can take care of that.
I'd like to move the amendment, Mr. Chair, and again, it's the A13 amendment.
Okay. Representative Anderson moves the A13 amendment. All those in... Oh, yeah. Any other questions or comments? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Okay. So hopefully we have the bill in the shape that the author would like it. Are there any other testifiers for the bill? Come forward. Okay. I think you're on the list, so why don't you come down and go ahead first, and then we'll get you as soon as he's finished. Oh, okay, I guess we're... Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Egger, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And we're a trade association, and our membership consists of the 17,000 realtors working with both buyers and sellers throughout the state of Minnesota. I first want to really thank Representative Anderson for reaching out to us and and having this conversation about raising awareness. I think you know, the objective of raising awareness of radon, not just for people that are in a real estate transaction or that are buyers and sellers, but really raising the issue for all residents of the state, whether you're considering buying or selling a home, or whether you're like my parents and you've been in your home for 40 years and don't plan on moving. It's a good discussion to have and to figure out how to raise the level of awareness. And while we, you know, agree on the goal of raising awareness, we do have some significant concerns, and Representative Metza raised a couple of them on having mandatory testing as part of a real estate transaction. And I just want to highlight some of the questions that came to mind as we looked at the language, and that we'd like the committee just to consider as you're reviewing the bill. The language, although it's short, it does raise a number of different questions. For example, the question was raised earlier: what kind of a test? Well, the language isn't specific. You know, one could presume that it's a short test, but there are varying timelines for doing tests, the short tests and longer tests. What should be the duration of any test? What is the timing of the test? There's some information I think that the Department of Health could maybe speak to that's available on their website that talks about the impact of the season, and Representative Anderson touched on the fact that in the winter when your house is closed up, you may get a different result on a short test than you would in the summer with windows open. What area of the home would you be testing? Where would you be placing any kind of testing equipment? Who would perform the test? You know, what are their credentials? Are they certified? Are they licensed? Is it a take-home test that you then send into a lab? How would any results be shared between the seller, the tester, and any potential buyers? How would that process work? You know, how would the results be used? Would there be a trigger based on some level? Maybe it's the EPA action level or some other number. And if the test comes back at a certain level, is there mitigation required, and is that negotiated, or would that be the responsibility of the seller? What if, although this is a requirement, and we certainly, when you pass laws around here, Mr. Chair, you expect people to follow them, what would happen if a seller didn't test, and you get all the way through the real estate transaction, and either the seller realizes that there was a requirement they didn't follow, or the buyer realizes that they didn't receive any test results? What would be the process for addressing those kinds of situations? There's a question just on the effective date that's in the bill. I think it refers to sales closed with closing dates of August 1st, 2013. And Mr. Chair, the amendment, as Representative Anderson described, focuses on, it changes the focus of the bill to when a property is listed. And so an effective date based on closing may be confusing if you have a property, say, that's listed right now, and the bill requires testing before listing, but the closing date is out past August 1st. So just a question on how that might work. And you know, lastly, Mr. Chair, we certainly believe that sellers, anybody preparing to sell their home or anybody who owns a home, should consider having a radon test done. So that's not the question. The question is it appropriate, or should the state mandate that test and tie it to the property transfer? And you know, we think information is the way to address this, and raising the awareness so that as we move forward, that the more the public is aware, the more people do radon tests outside of being under a time crunch to either buy or sell a home, that actually we're getting at that awareness issue, and the people are doing what I think Representative Anderson is hoping that they would do. You know, with that, Mr. Chair, we would just, you know, pledge our commitment to continue to work with Representative Anderson on kind of the awareness issue and how we can go about doing that. There's a Department of Health policy bill that actually is up this afternoon, and Representative Liebling's committee on disclosure, which is something that we certainly don't oppose, and we're happy to work with the authors of the bill, the Department of Health, Representative Anderson, on making sure that's something that will get more information out to people that maybe otherwise aren't getting it. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to share some comments.
All right. Representative Anderson, those are some good questions. And you're willing to work with the testifier on some of those issues?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I appreciate we visited with Mr. Egger a number of times, and I think we have the same basic thoughts in mind about raising the awareness, which is what my purpose is also. I'm not a big mandates fan, and in this would be, but we feel it's the importance is high enough to do it in this case. But yes, I certainly want to work with them, realtors, and if nothing else, to raise the awareness in a higher disclosure fashion to make people aware that when they buy an existing home, it should be tested for radon. Yes.
But we are laying the bill over, so there's certainly time to do that. So we have one more testifier, is that right?
Yeah.
Or is it okay?
Mr. Chair, thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of this bill. My name is Dan Steck. I'm a nuclear physicist who was fortunate enough to have a day job as a university professor. This job gave me the freedom to research the effects of radiation exposure in Minnesota homes. This research started in 1983 when my wife and I were building our home in Collegeville. I discovered that our home had radon concentrations much higher than the national average home, and that my neighbors had even more radon. In the years that followed, I have measured radon in thousands of homes across the state, in places like Oslo, Moose Lake, Starbuck, Rochester, Jackson. I found that the typical Minnesota house has about three times more radon than the national average, and that elevated indoor radon concentrations are common all over Minnesota. Scientific studies during the last 20 years have established that that long-term residential radon exposure at concentrations like we have in our homes is a significant cause of lung cancer. Public health and radiation protection organizations like the World Health Organization, the EPA, the Surgeon General, recommend that we take action to reduce our exposures to radon concentrations like we have in our homes. There are two pieces of good news. First, it is fairly easy to reduce radon in our homes if we know we have elevated radon. In an independent study, I found that Minnesota mitigation contractors routinely were able to reduce radon concentration from high levels to levels very near that you'd find in outdoor air. This reduction eliminates most of the lung cancer risk in those homes that are mitigated. Second, mitigating homes would save many lives and a lot of money in the long run. Now, unfortunately, few people survive lung cancer for more than a year after it's diagnosed. It turns out to be more effective to save lives and a lot less expensive to extend a person's lives by preventing the lung cancer rather than treating it after it develops. This year, approximately 700 Minnesotans will die from lung cancer due to radon exposure. Those 700 victims will lose more than 16 years of life simply because they lived in unmitigated homes. It's time to take meaningful action to encourage all Minnesotans to mitigate high radon homes. If HF 816 were to become law, I believe that more Minnesotans would discover that their homes have unacceptably high radon concentrations. That might lead them to take some protective action. That's why I support HF 816. Mr. Chair, I thank you for this time.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Okay. Would anyone else like to speak on this bill? All right. Seeing no more questions or comments, do you have any closing remarks, Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would just renew my motion to have House File 816 as amended held over in the committee. Thank you very much.
Okay. So Representative Anderson will lay over the bill. And next we have Representative Allen, House File 485. Okay. Representative Fisher, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
I sure have. I'd like to move their approval, please.
Okay, thank you. So, Representative Fisher moves the approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Okay. Can we have someone move Representative Allen's bill?
So moved.
Okay. So, Representative Isaacson moves House File 485. For passage to public safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we also have presenting an amendment at this time. But
and that would be the A2 amendment?
Yes.
Representative Isaacson, would you move the passage of the A2 amendment? Did you hear me?
Representative
sorry, I asked a question here. I'm sorry. Representative Isaacson, would you move the A2 amendment?
So moved.
Thank you. Go ahead and present the amendment. Can you tell us what the amendment will do?
Oh, the amendment it strikes all of Article 3. It deals with the 72-hour hold. There's some issues with that. So okay. Under the federal law, and so we struck that out. So.
Okay. Are there any questions about the A2 amendment? Well, seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment to get the bill in the fashion that the author would like, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. The motion passes.
Ed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I present House File 485. It is this this bill. We call it the No Wrong Door legislation, and it's based on the No Wrong Door report, which was the product of 18 months of work on the part of service providers, law enforcement professionals, philanthropy advocates, and survivors of sex trafficking from around the state, with coordination and input from the Departments of Public Safety, Health and Human Services, and the generous financial support of the Women's Foundation. It represents the best ideas and best practices from around our state and around the country. This bill will put in place a statewide system of safe and secure shelter, trauma-informed care and services, and comprehensive training for law enforcement and others to effectively identify victims and to aggressively investigate and prosecute cases of child sex trafficking. It is an evidence-based, trauma-informed model. Stopping the trafficking of our children is not only a moral imperative, but also a sound investment for the state. A 2012 cost-benefit study commissioned by the Minnesota Indian Women Resource Center, which I believe is included in your materials. It was conducted by the University of Minnesota and Indiana State University and showed a savings of 34 state tax dollars for every dollar invested in a model like Safe Harbor, No Wrong Door model. And to get into more specifics regarding the components of the bill, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Bauer, who's the Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership.
Okay. State your name for the record and give us your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Jeff Bauer, Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. And just really want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And, of course, a big thank you to Representative Allen for being a champion for us on this issue and for girls all around the state. I just want to walk really quickly through this bill you have in front of you. So the first thing I want to say is this is really it's the culmination of a bill that was passed in 2011. It was Minnesota's Safe Harbor Law. And since that time, for the past 18 months, as Representative Allen said, there's been a really comprehensive group from around the state building what would be the model that we could build in Minnesota to serve children who have been trafficked. And this was really a response to two undeniable trends that we have seen in our own program, that I know Breaking Free has seen in their programs. And the two undeniable trends are these. One is that the trafficked children who we see coming through our Pride program at our organization, we're getting younger and younger. Even when I started this job in 2008, the average age of the girls we would see coming through our program was 16, 17, 18 years old. In just a short amount of time, that average age has shifted downward to 13, 14, 15 years old. So that's one trend. And the other trend that I can tell you that there's no denying is that there's more and more of these kids every year. And so we need to do something about it, and this bill is our response. So to start out with the bill, Article 1 in your bill does three things. The first thing it does is it establishes a director, safe harbor director within the Minnesota Department of Health. This person will really be tasked with overseeing the entire statewide intervention system, with administering grant funds, with also the evaluation and the accountability pieces of this legislation. The second thing we're proposing is the establishment of six regional navigator positions around the state. These would be grant-funded positions. These would not be state employees, and they'd be housed within existing organizations. Roughly, they would be in the northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, and two in the metro area. And these people's responsibility would essentially be to connect the dots. And so if we find one of these children, whether she's in Crookston or Mankato or anywhere else in the state, this is the person that knows how to connect her to the shelter she needs, the services she needs, the legal advocacy she needs, all of those things. And then last but not least, in Article 1 is program evaluation. We're really doing something here that hasn't been done, not just in the state of Minnesota, but really not around the country. And so we want to make sure we have a robust evaluation plan for this first biennium to really make sure we're getting the outcomes we want, that we have the accountability and transparency we want. Moving on to Article 2, this will look familiar to some of you who were involved in this discussion 2 years ago. When we initially passed Safe Harbor in 2011, the law was really designed to cover any child under the age of 18. This is something that not only advocates and survivors and service providers have told us is the correct approach, but it's also something prosecutors have told us is the correct approach, and law enforcement as well. Due to a number of circumstances, 2 years ago, we were not able to have the law cover every child under 18. There was an age distinction written into that law, so it was 15 and under. And then there was a mandatory first diversion for 16 and 17-year-olds. Over the course of the past 18 months, it's become even more clear that we really just need to have this law cover every child under the age of 18, that's the appropriate response. So Article 2 does that. As Representative Allen mentioned, we're striking all of Article 3. This was some technical changes to hold and detention for children. It had come to our attention that there may be some potential issues with how that interacts with federal law, so we're going to take some more time to work that out. It doesn't substantively affect the bill or what we're trying to do at this time. And then last but not least, there is money attached to this. It's in Article 4. And so the way to look at the appropriation the most simply is that anything having to do with the shelter and housing pieces of it will be in the Department of Human Services. We don't actually have an allocation coming from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. It's all Department of Human Services. And then all of the staffing and grant funds are in the Minnesota Department of Health. And so if you look at just the housing part of the bill, there's $4 million for shelter construction and renovation around the state. Right now, in the entire state of Minnesota, there are exactly 4 shelter beds dedicated to child victims of sex trafficking in the entire state. And they all exist at Breaking Free in St. Paul. And so we estimate on any given night in the state of Minnesota, when this law goes into effect, we're going to need between 35 and 40 around the state. So the construction dollars are meant to fill that gap between the 4 that we have and the 35 to 40 that we need. The other $4.5 million is pure operating dollars for those shelter beds. It's a bit higher of a number than you would see for a typical bed for a homeless youth. The reason that is because trafficked children who come in need a couple of things. One is they need their housing to be safe and secure, a heightened level of security. Often these children have a trafficker very directly pursuing them, and we need to make sure they're safe. And the second piece is they come in with such trauma from what they've experienced, the level of therapeutic services that they need when they come in are higher, And so the per diem cost per bed is a bit higher for this population. So the remaining couple of pieces in this, we're proposing a comprehensive safe harbor services fund. This is to cover everything from mental health services to physical trauma to all the way to basic needs that would be available to organizations around the state. And then finally, and I think one of the most important pieces of this legislation is the Safe Harbor Training Fund. Child sex trafficking cases are notoriously hard to investigate. And so law enforcement around the state, as we've been traveling around talking about this bill, they want access to the training to effectively investigate these cases and put the bad guys away. The other thing about these cases is that the victims are very, very hard to identify. Almost always they will not self-identify, and so law enforcement and others need to know how to ask the right questions. And so the training fund we're proposing would be to train folks all across the state to know how to do that. So that's the bill in a nutshell. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you want the rest of the testimony first or questions now.
I don't have any questions at the moment, so let's go ahead with the other testifiers. Okay.
So we have a couple of representatives here today, Mr. Chair and committee members, from Breaking Free, an organization in St. Paul who does, I think, heroic work with sex trafficking victims, and they're here to make a brief statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And on behalf of Breaking Free, thank you for those who came out and did the site visit on Monday. My name is Nikki Beasley. I'm the Director of Programs at Breaking Free. victims of human trafficking are especially vulnerable to the debilitating physical and psychological symptoms of trauma resulting from their repeated, intrusive, and long-term abuse. Providers working with this population emphasize that trauma recovery is critical to a victim's ability to repair and regain his or her life. Minor victims of domestic sex trafficking are frequently in need of services, including out-of-home placement. We as providers are advocating for facilities in which these victims can receive support, comprehensive services, and a start on the path to recovery. We recognize that these minors meet the federal definition of a minor victim of sex trafficking and therefore deserve the humanitarian protections called for under the law. Specialized and intensive care is needed to ensure long-term stability and exit out of the life. We know that these programs need to be safe, trauma-informed, population-specific, and adequately funded. Furthermore, programs currently housing domestically sex trafficked victims, such as runaway and homeless youth shelters, detention facilities, and group homes, need additional training and access to appropriate resources to better serve this population. The future safety and stability of this vulnerable population of victims rests on our ability to provide a safe space in which they can recover from the trauma of their trafficking situation and be given a chance at a new life free from exploitation. Thank you.
Okay, the next testifier, just state your name for the record. And
hi, Mr. Chair and committee. I am Jennifer Gaines, and I am a client at Breaking Free. I'm a survivor of sex trafficking. I was recruited when I was 14. And back then, you know, because I'm a little older now, that was maybe 28 years ago. And back then, nobody knew how to help me. And they tried different things and put me in different places where my trafficker would find me. And then it got to the point where I couldn't even reunite with my family because he terrorized my family. So I can really vouch for the fact that we need specially trained staff to treat us or whatever, or provide services, not only because of the safety issue, but because of the social stigma and how defensive people in sex trafficking are. And I think that had I have gotten the services that I now get from Breaking Free back then, maybe I wouldn't have been stuck or felt trapped in that life for so many years. And Breaking Free, even now, we have to turn away a lot of people, and there's a lot of things that they're not able to help us with. So this is an issue that I'm very passionate about. Thank you.
Do we have any questioners for the author or the testifiers? Seeing none, do you have any remarks that you'd like to make?
No, Mr. Chair, we'll keep it short.
Okay, all right. Oh, sorry. Okay, Representative O'Neill, you have a question?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Just a small little question. So the appropriations, are they going to help Breaking Free, or is this like a totally a new government agency being established? I'm a little confused as to the appropriations.
Go ahead, testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, thank you for the question. It's not a new government program. The funds that we're talking about establishing would be administered through a competitive RFP process. And so an organization like Breaking Free would be able to apply for those grant funds, but as would many organizations from around the state.
Thank you. So it's a granting program to nonprofits like themselves. Okay.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine are probably a little tougher questions. And when I ask them, you're going to think that I'm against you, but I'm not. My big concern, this is something that has bothered me for a long time, along with a lot of other youth programs out there, in that sometimes, even in the case of your organization, we come in on the back end and we try to treat things after the fact. Do you know of anything out there right now that would be a good deterrent before young people get into this? Is there anything out there now that's being worked on?
Go ahead.
Thank you for the question. Right now, what Breaking Free and many others are working on is the number one thing to combat what you're asking is the demand. If we stop the demand of these children being trafficked, that would get rid of the problem.
I probably have a series of questions, Mr. Chair. The other thing is that the traffickers themselves, is there anything in place that will go after these people with, for lack of a better word, vigor?
To the testifier.
So I can keep looking at your representative. One of the things, when we first started talking about this bill a couple of years ago, we had a lot of discussion with prosecutors and law enforcement around the state. And the concern that they had, to be honest, at the time was if we change the law to take away sort of their coercive power. So say a 16-year-old girl comes into the system and the prosecutor says, look, if you don't testify against your trafficker, you're going to be in trouble too. We had some long talks about that. And a number of county attorneys at that time changed their approach here in the metro area, up in Duluth, down in Rochester and other areas, to really use a victim-centered approach, to say no matter what, if you're a child, we're not going to criminalize you, we're not going to coerce you, we're not going to threaten you. And what they've found by changing that approach to a victim-centered approach is that the trafficking victims are far more willing and supported in their testimony against their traffickers. And because of that, they've actually gotten a lot more convictions, and they've gotten longer sentences, and they've built stronger cases to really get at the bad guys. And so this is one of those maybe rare instances where the solution we're proposing is good for everyone. It's good for the victims, it's good for law enforcement, and it puts the traffickers away for a long time.
Okay. Excuse me, could you state your name for the record?
Jeff Bauer, the Family Branch.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. The other question is, are there models out there that would prove that the $13 million or whatever it is that you guys are asking for are going to achieve results?
Mr. Bauer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the good news is yes. The answer is yes. The state of Minnesota actually funded back in 2006 a project called the Ramsey Runaway Intervention Program right here in Ramsey County. And the, what the program was early intervention using a public health model for children who, unfortunately, because of the parameters of the project, had to have been sexually assaulted at least two times already to be in the program, because that's what there was money for. But what they found in the study of that program, doing these kind of interventions, the success rate is amazing. It was, I believe, over 90% in that program. And in fact, the children who went through that program had better outcomes on a number of measures than just mainstream children who had never been sexually exploited. And so we know it works here in Minnesota, and we really just want to expand that so it's not just a metro area issue. It's we can get these services to everyone from around the state.
Mrs. Green, do you have a follow-up question?
Yes, I do. As the youth, and I assume that most of the youth you deal with are female, although I would probably guess that's not the rule. Is there a limit? Like if someone comes in, goes through your program, is back on the street, comes back, is there a limit to how many times you take them back? And my question is there basically, is there anything in place to avoid people using the system when someone who might benefit from it more could use that spot?
Go ahead, Mr. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, I've been well trained. I always look right back over.
Good for you.
You know, the first and most important premise of all of this, Representative, is that these children are not criminals. And so if they get referred to services and for whatever reason, whether it's trauma, whether it's because they're scared, they run from those services and they show up in the system again, it doesn't matter how many times they do that, they're still not criminals.
Okay.
And so we don't want to take a juvenile justice approach to them. We know, just to be really honest with you, a lot of these kids, they're tough kids. They've been through a lot, and they will run, and they probably will run multiple times. But for a lot of them, maybe it's the fourth time, maybe it's the fifth time, they finally connect with that person who they can build trust with, and it's the only way they can get out. And so that's what we're trying to build, is an opportunity for them to keep connecting to trustworthy adults who can help them.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Do you deal,
Representative Allen, please.
May I add something to that?
Yes.
And this is a different framework, too, because the statute, what it does, it not only decriminalizes prostitution, but the victims are now treated as children in need of protection and then eligible for the services that we do provide for those children. So.
We have about 4 minutes. I just want to say we have two more questions, so if you can be brief, that'd be
okay. I'll just ask one more, then
okay,
if somebody else wants to, they can.
Very good.
There's other agencies out there and stuff that help, and one that I know in particular of is Teen Challenge. You guys work in coordination with other groups like that to help with overflow or maybe help them?
Go ahead, Ms. Brower.
So thanks for the question. That's a great question. You know, there's a lot of crossover in populations. You know, one of the things we know is that any child who's homeless is at extreme risk for being sexually exploited. I think the statistic is once a child is on the street, it's an average of 48 hours before they're approached by a trafficker. And so we really see this model, in addition to the $8 million that the Youth Moving Forward group is asking for the homeless shelters, which is critically important. You know, they need a place to send kids to, because, you know, the homeless shelters are really important to get kids off the street, to protect them, to make sure that, you know, we're preventing that exploitation on the front end. But once a child has been trafficked, the level of support and services they need, the specialized housing and care they need, it's a whole different ballgame. And so we want not only Teen Challenge, the homeless shelters and others to know that this system exists as a resource, so that they have the training to identify a victim, they know where they can send that victim to get the appropriate help they need. So we look forward to working with that group and all kinds of groups.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, first of all, thank you, Representative Allen, for bringing this bill forward, and thank you for the testifiers to have the courage to be up here and exercise some good power to make some changes. I think that's just fantastic, and I really respect and appreciate what you shared with us today. I have to say that I wanted to comment on a couple of things Representative Green talked about. First of all, some really good questions that were very helpful to kind of flesh some of this out, and I think that's very useful. I would remark on one question that I wouldn't care if the child came back 10,000 times. I would want the money to be there to support them regardless. I understand where there are definitely situations where people can abuse safety net systems, and I think that's a possibility. This is one where I would not care at that point what it took to finally rip somebody out of the cycle in that respect. So I think that I would support on that level for sure. And the other part that makes me feel very good is you're taking time to coordinate with other folks. I think that's how we create a stronger net overall, and I would just encourage you to continue doing so and just keep us posted on what more we can do. I'd be concerned because of time, so I'll be quick, but I'd be concerned to know if there were any other areas we're seeing where much like the prosecuting versus victim model, as you talked about it, that we find the government's inadvertently being burdensome in your efforts to get work done. And so if there is some way, come and talk to me or another representative about how we can alleviate that burden so we can be more effective. And again, thank you very much.
Okay, last question, Ms. O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So I was just, you know, I'm sort of the math person on the committee. I'm just doing some quick math, and he's already laughing. So if you're serving a total of 35 victims, right? And I think it was $1 million for Safe Harbor. So I'm assuming that's about what it takes to serve 35 is $1 million. And if I do that math, you can just say yes or no in a second. So if I do the math, it's $28,571 per victim, $28,000 per victim per year, I believe that is. So is that accurate? So it's $1 million for the program, and then you're building shelters and everything else, but is it just 35? That's all you can serve with that?
Mr. Bauer, go ahead.
Thank you for the question. I'm glad you're good at math.
the
35 number is actually, that's on any given night in the shelter system around the state. Those children may stay 2 days, they may stay 90 days, and so it would be far greater over the course of a year than 35 children coming through the shelter and housing, several hundred at least. And the other part is there will be several more hundred going through who are just connected to the services and the counseling and those parts of the program that may never actually go through the housing. And so, it would be several hundred children per year going through one part of the system or another.
Just a quick follow-up, just clarification.
Okay.
So 35 beds then?
Yeah, 35 beds on any given night we estimate would be full around the state.
So then it would be accurate to say that for the 35 beds it's 28,000 per year?
You know, I'd have to look back at the math rather than do it in my head here, but I'd be glad to follow up with you.
It's the million divided by 35.
I'm not sure which million you're talking about.
It said 1 million appropriated for Safe Harbors. 1 million each of the biennium.
Oh, okay. I know what you're asking.
For a Safe Harbor program.
So you're actually talking about the Comprehensive Services Fund. That actually doesn't have to do with the shelter and housing. That would be a statewide grant fund. And so organizations from around the state could apply for some of that money. And that could be anything from an organization that wants to provide mental health counseling to an organization that does legal advocacy for victims, to an organization that does things like basic needs. That would essentially be a competitive grant fund that all kinds of organizations around the state could apply for, and that would be up to the statewide director to determine the RFP and the grant amounts and those types of details.
Okay, thank you. Representative Isaacson renews his motion that House File 485 be passed and referred to public safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members.
Okay. The next bill is House File 829. We're still waiting for Representative Dabney. So, Representative Allen, if you want to come back, we'll do your House File 829. Would one of the members like to move House File House 829? Who
was me? Okay, I'm just kidding. It was just
okay, Representative Metza moves House File 829, which is moved to pass and referred to civil law. Representative Allen, do you have any amendments or? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I believe we do have an amendment.
Okay, all right. And so, Representative Metza, before you leave, would you like to move Amendment DE1 for House File 829? Thank you. So, any questions about the amendment? Can you explain the amendment to us?
It's a delete all amendment, and it, I think Mr. Alwood, who would be joining me soon, hopefully, it basically, there was a number of provisions that this bill, it's a comprehensive bill, and so it removed a number of the provisions regarding, yes.
Mr. Elwood, we're looking for explanation of delete, DE1 amendment. Would you give us some insights into that?
I'd be delighted to, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. We came out of the gate with a fairly extensive set of proposals that were on the order of a lot of procedural changes in landlord-tenant law, and they covered a wide range of areas. We sat down with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association and discussed the each one. And in the course of those discussions, it became clear that some of those provisions in the original bill needed some more work, and we needed some more time, and we have agreed to park a number of those things for the interim and have some further discussions. But there were several provisions that you see in the delete all that they felt were ready for prime time, and we were agreed with them with that, and we were very delighted for their assistance and willingness to work with us on these provisions. And I think the ones that we have before you have been things that with the legal aid all across the state have been seeing problems that these would procedural problems that would fix. And one the delete all does three things. The first one is to make permanent the renter protections that were put into place several years ago during the foreclosure crisis. As you are probably all well aware, when a tenant is living in a property that is being foreclosed upon and the redemption period ends, prior to the federal Congress interceding, essentially the tenant was the victim. The tenant had to get out with the homeowner, even if the lease extended beyond the redemption period. And so it only seemed fair that the tenant at least got to stay to the end of the lease. There was a contract there. And so the Congress enacted these protections. They were to be sunsetted. In the Dodd-Frank bill, they were extended for a couple more years. And what this bill does in Minnesota is to just make those permanent. We have talked to the Minnesota Bankers Association on this, the independent community bankers, the Minnesota Credit Union, and all those folks feel that their procedures are now in place, they're used to this, and they're comfortable with this provision moving forward. So that's what the first two pieces do. The second piece simply extends the appeal period for 5 days. And the reason for that is that you have, under current law, 10 days from the date that the decision is issued. Unfortunately, sometimes that decision doesn't get to the office for several days. And so, in fact, your appeal period, in effect, is no longer 10 days, but much shorter than that. So we were suggesting that if we just extended the appeal period 5 more days, that would account essentially for the mailing and the getting the actual opinion in your hands and to be able to look at it. Frankly, we've surveyed our folks all around the state. There are not a ton of appeals. But when a situation does arrive, the timing of the period is a little bit too aggressive the way it works in practice, but not on paper. So we're extending that 5 days. And the final provision is a very, very technical provision. It's kind of a cleanup. So under the Tenant Remedies Act, in order for you to take an action, you have to put your rent into escrow when it's due. Well, one of those anomalies in law is, well, what if the rent isn't due? What if you've already paid it? So it's a weird little deal that you've already paid the rent, and now you might have to actually pay double rent when you really already paid the rent. So what this essentially, this little tiny section says, if the rent isn't due, you don't have to put it into escrow in order to get into court and have your day. And that's what these three provisions do. Sorry for the lengthy babbling.
Thank you for the explanation. All right, members, do you have any questions about the amendment as moved? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The amendment passes. So you have the bill in the fashion that you'd like.
Yes,
so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe Mr. Alwood pretty much described
covered the bill?
What was left
okay.
of the
all
bill.
Right.
So I don't think there's
anyone have any questions for either the testifier or the author of the bill? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a broad question. Is the system working now? Are these changes, are they going to help the system and make things better, smoother? Why do we want to make these changes permanent?
To the testifier, yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I would argue yes, it would make it smoother and work better and fairly, especially the renter protection piece, because, I mean, it just seemed that if the foreclosure date was on December 31st, but your lease was to March 1st, it seems only fair that you should be able to stay. You had made an arrangement with the owner of that house. It wasn't your fault that, you know, the house got foreclosed upon as a renter. And you have a contract with that person, and that contract should be fulfilled. So we just think that this, I mean, it seems that everybody seemed that seemed to think it was the right thing to do, it was the fair thing to do, and now that it's been in place for 5 years or so, it seems that all the players in the system, the lenders, the foreclosing parties, the servicers, everybody, the tenants, the owners, people are comfortable with that system now. The procedures are in place, the notices and the timing is all in place, and it seemed the time is ripe to just make it permanent.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just seems that once something is put into place and it has a sunset, we tend to want to make things permanent. And I would just trust, and by your explanation, this does seem to make sense, but a lot of things that have the original intent of not lasting forever sometimes wind up lasting longer than the original intent.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I appreciate what you're saying, but oftentimes the reason sunsets are put on is because people want to see how it works. And if it works well, then it makes sense to make it permanent. This is one of those situations.
All right. Is there anyone else that would like to offer testimony on this bill? Seeing none, and I don't have any other questioners, all those in favor of the bill, please. All right,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Representative Zaros, did you have a question? Or I thought you raised your hand. I just don't want to pass up.
I have a couple. It's all right.
Yes. Okay, go ahead, Representative Ross. I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand.
No, that's all right, Mr. Chair. I thought we were going to finish up with the testifiers and then take questions for the author. But so I have a few questions for the author. For Representative Allen. My concern with the changes for notice for a landlord to come into a property, do those get deleted in the DE? Whew. Then I have no question.
All right, very good. Representative Metza renews his motion that the House File 829 be passed and referred to civil law. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right. Representative Dabney was here a moment ago. Is he? Okay. Our next bill is House File 536, and I think we have a couple testifiers. All right, okay, let's go to an announcement.
Next week we'll be taking up the language for the governor's budget dealing with housing. So that'll be next week, Wednesday. And then Representative Isaacson also will have a piece of, or a bill coming before the committee next week. So,
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Question. Will they have the revised budget out by then, or will it be the existing budget?
I have received a revised documents for my other committee jobs, so I anticipate, but I don't know. I anticipate that we'll have language for housing, but I don't know.
Thanks.
Any other announcements? Okay. All right. Would the testifiers like to come up, and we can at least hear your testimony before we get the bill moved here? But
we know Ryan's here, so we got one.
Yeah. And Ron is here, too.
Come on.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Sorry that you have to listen to me twice today, but this is also a bill that we've been working with Senator Representative Dabney. And we work with the Minnesota Association of Realtors and the Real Property Section of the Bar Association on. And it's simply the guts of the bill is to provide some notice and disclosure to a contract for deed purchaser that explains that the essentially that this is a complicated transaction, that you're assuming some risks that you ought to know about, go into the transaction with your eyes wide open and get a few days to think about it. And there are a couple of technical provisions in the bill. And, Mr. Chair, it's the will of the committee. If they want me to walk through the items, I'll be happy to do that.
That'd be great. That would be great. Thank you. So go ahead, Mr. Elwood.
You have the amendment. Is there the amendment bill? Oh, you got it. Oh, this is good. I apologize. I'm sorry. I'm a little discombobulated. I'm supposed to be in two places at once, and there's an old saying, you can't be in two places at once if you know where at all. So that's where I am today.
Mr. Chair.
So the first...
Hold on. Just one second, Mr. Elwood. Representative Zerwas, you have a question?
I don't think we got an amendment.
House File 536?
I don't think we got the amendment.
We don't have an amendment listed. Is there... No. He's just going to walk through the bill, I believe.
Oh, that you're looking for the amendment.
Yeah. 536. Hold on. Well, I guess we are nowhere at all, Mr. Elwood.
Right. Right here.
You found it?
Yeah.
So the House research memo on it is in our folders, but it doesn't appear that the amendment is actually in our folders. Is that what you have, Representative Zerwas? Okay.
Well, no author, no amendment, but...
Can we have you lay it over and pick it up again later? Mr. Chair, is that possible?
I think we should.
Hold on, let's see.
No, this is the original, yeah. Thank you so much.
Do you have a copy of it, Mr. Elwood?
Representative Dadme's here.
He might have a copy. I do not.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney?
Yeah.
836.
So.
Here.
Representative Dabney.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My apologies.
Yes.
I was working with the committee's legislative assistant on copying the DE2 or is it DE1 amendment?
Okay.
Let's get that right. The H536 DE1 amendment. She's coming down at this time.
Okay. We were debating whether or not we would have to lay the bill over because we did not receive the amendment. I understand that it was mentioned and that it was met the deadline, but we didn't get it in the folder. So, versus Mariani,
Mr. Chair, it probably would be appropriate since the author is here for someone to move the bill. If the amendment has been posted, then that's appropriate for him to talk about the amendment. But obviously, it would facilitate our discussion here to have it in front of us. Okay. And I would not have a vote without the physical bill before
sure,
us.
Sure.
Or amendment, rather.
Representative Anderson, you have a comment as well?
And Mr. Chair, again, the meeting wasn't posted until like 6 o'clock last evening. There seems to be some confusion here. So I would encourage us to wait on this and do it on another day.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I guess we're going to...
We're good.
Representative Daphne.
We're good.
Okay.
I understand. I'm not quite sure
what happened.
How we got into this position, but we're in this position now.
Yes,
it's
right.
It's the old line, what am I doing in my handbasket and where is it we're going?
Yeah.
So I understand the need for the Committee for Public Transparency to delay consideration of the bill until, is it Monday? Until Monday, and proper posting is achieved.
Okay.
And I hope to see you all back on Monday then.
Well, thank you, Representative Dabney, and thank you, Representative Mariani and Representative Anderson, for your advice on the issue. And I think we'll, that's what we'll do. We'll lay the bill over until.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other announcements or issues before the committee? Yes, yes. All right, the committee is now adjourned.